Welcome to another episode of the 3 Minute Therapy podcast. I'm Dr. Michael Edelstein, a rational emotive behavior therapist in private practice. And I have as my regular partner these days, Kevin Benbow, who also is a rational emotive behavior therapist in private practice. That's REBT. And a word about REBT for new people. REBT was devised in the 1950s by a genius in the field, Dr. Albert Ellis, who's written over 80 books. That's E-L-L-I-S. And REBT is the basis of our podcast. So we discuss just about everything, not necessarily everything, but almost everything from an REBT, rational emotive behavior therapy perspective. We're honored today to have as a guest a speaker and author and podcaster, Howie Jacobson, who has an interesting subject that attracted us called You Can Change Other People. Welcome, Howie.
Thank you. It's great to be here. You've been a guest on my podcast twice, so I'm looking forward to the role reversal.
Okay, very good. So is your book out now? You Can Change Other People.
It is. It's been out for almost 2 weeks, and
great,
we're setting the world on fire.
Wonderful, wonderful. And you've written at least two or three other books, or co-authored them. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, this is my seventh.
Wow. So what are the most popular titles?
So the popular ones include Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, which I co-authored with Dr. T. Colin Campbell, Proteinaholic, which I co-authored with Dr. Garth Davis, and Sick to Fit, which I co-authored with Josh Lajani.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. So it sounds like one of your areas of expertise is diet and health.
It has been. That's where I have approached this. I've also been a performance coach, an executive coach for many years. And one of the joys of living in both worlds is that I get to steal the best from each and bring it to the other. And, you know, they regard me as, you know, as an innovator when I'm just a larcenist.
Yeah, very good. I like that. And I'm the same as you. I stole all my ideas, or I, as you say, plagiarized all my ideas from Albert Ellis. Everything I say, I learned from Albert Ellis as his client when I was 18 years old, and as his follower, and then later on as his colleague. And Kevin, is that the same with you? Just about everything you recommend to clients and teach clients, you learn from the works of Albert Ellis?
Basically, that is true. That is the bulk of what I do. Everything I've learned. Now, every now and then I spritz in a little bit of CBT and other things as they seem to be appropriate. But for the most part, it's looking for those shoulds and musts and generalizations.
Very good. Very good. And Howie, when Kevin and I came across the title of your book, You Can Change Other People, we were wondering if you meant that humorously or not, because our view is you really can't change other people. You can influence them to change. If you give them poison and they die, I guess you've changed them. That's Kevin's idea, but otherwise not. So is You Can Change Other People shorthand for you can influence other people to change?
Sure. It is. It was meant because we hear this phrase all the time. You can't change other people. You can only change yourself. And if that were true, you guys wouldn't have a job and I wouldn't have a job, because the way I think about it is if I have a conversation with someone, and because of that conversation, they start doing new things, different things. They start thinking about things and approaching them and acting differently. I have helped create a discontinuity with the past, and they've changed. So what I don't mean by the title is you can force someone to be a different person. So the title, I guess, is it's a little provocative, And it's, and we did that kind of on purpose because so many people don't think that they can help the people around them make positive changes, that they don't even try, or they keep, you know, they keep doing what they have been doing, which is to say, criticizing, giving advice, trying to motivate people over and over again. And that doesn't work. And so when we say, well, if everything I'm doing doesn't work, then obviously you can't change other people. But the interesting thing is, whenever anybody says that to you, you can't change other people, they're trying to change you because they're saying it in response to something you're doing.
Right. And you have, I believe, 4 steps for doing this, for influencing or changing other people, starting with ask for permission. Is that correct?
Right. The first step is really like the deliverable is they give you permission to be a thought partner. And the way we think about that step is it's go from critic to ally. Because usually, you know, so as therapists, you're naturally in alliance, right? We all are human, but your basic stance is not judgmental of your clients. Right. And you probably don't have years of history of nagging and badgering them and fighting with them.
Well, I do
right?
some so of you, that.
You have a huge advantage over like someone trying to influence their child or their spouse or their coworker. So the first thing is to shift from critic to ally, which means to get clear on what your motivation is. What's the positive intent behind what may be frustration? Like, you know, you're really frustrated. This person isn't, you know, they're not eating right. They keep on, they have a heart condition, they have diabetes, and they still go out and they make these dumb food choices, and you're so angry at them. So let's get clear. And this is, I think, is right up the REBT alley. Like, what's the positive motivation behind what I'm doing? What do I care about that makes this such a painful issue?
Yes, very good. Very good. And since you mentioned being angry at them, REBT would say start with unconditional other acceptance. Accept them as the imperfect humans they are that don't have to change, although it would be lovely if they did. And then you're on the road to being an ally rather than a critic.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I just wrote that down because now I'm going to steal that too.
Please do.
I'm now Albert Ellis's grand plagiarist.
Right. Unconditional other acceptance.
Unconditional other acceptance. And what I find for myself, and I've heard this from other people, is that a step in that direction is to first forgive ourselves for not being able to do that. Right. So to kind of reorient everything towards the positive, what do I want for them? Why, you know, what's behind my anger? It's love, it's care. Right. And what do I think they're trying to get? Right. Everyone who has a bad habit is trying to accomplish something good with that bad habit. Right. They're either unaware of the impact, or they don't know how to stop, or they know it's hurting them in the long term, but it's satisfying a short-term psychological need. So to just get in touch with, they're not bad, they're not evil, they're not trying to hurt themselves or you, they're doing the best they can.
Yes.
So that sounds a lot like, what was
unconditional
it again?
Other acceptance.
Unconditional, I have to slow down my handwriting. Other acceptance.
Right.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Good. And which I stole from Albert Ellis. Yeah.
And I like that. If I could just jump in here, I like that stance of moving from critic to ally, because you're right, Howie. We can't, we would all be out of a job if we were just into nagging everybody into submission. And so I think it is about coming alongside them, encouraging them. But the one little thing is, quite often behavioral change comes in fits and starts. People don't change immediately. They might, I know when I quit smoking, for example, it took me, and I quit smoking twice. It took me about 7 attempts each time to completely break myself of the habit. So there's an element of patience with our clients as well there as they strive to make these changes.
Yeah, very good. Patience is important. Hey, Howie, do we move on to a second step once we're an ally?
Yes, we do. We don't stop there. Although, you know, just stopping there actually can create great transformation, both in relationship, yeah. right? Because as Kevin was saying about, like, why am I not doing this? Why am I not succeeding? I'm trying and trying. There's a lot of shame that comes up for people. And so to be an ally means that we're not amplifying their shame, and we're not kind of reflecting it back to them like a parabolic arc of shame, right? When someone accepts you unconditionally, it makes it much easier for you to accept yourself.
Right.
So okay. at that point, we want to keep going with this idea of flipping from negative to positive. We say, what's the next step is to find out what's the outcome that they want. Right. Because at that point, like, oh, yeah, sure. You can think this through with me. Great. Let me tell you what to do. Right. So instead of that, we want to say, well, what are you going for? Right. We know you have a problem. It may be annoying or scary. But what's a positive outcome that you would want? What would energize you? And it often takes a lot of time to get someone to flip from negative to positive.
Yes, it does. And that's Kevin's point about patience. It could take a long time. Also, I've noticed once in a while, not with clients, but more with friends, that sometimes I might recommend something and they don't seem to be on board. But then one day in the future, they're doing it. So that's also goes along with patience and looking at the desired outcome. And it doesn't have to happen immediately.
Right. Like, you know, my understanding of neuroscience is that when we're focused on what we don't want, we're kind of in some degree of fight or flight, right? We're basically looking for where's the predator as opposed to where's the meal. And so when you shift someone into like an outcome, if someone says, well, I want to quit smoking, we say, great. Tell me how your life would be as a non-smoker. And they come up with a clear, compelling, meaningful picture. I'll be able to climb the mountain with my grandkids. I'll be able to run in that race. My insurance premiums will go down so I can afford better life insurance to protect my family. All those things. Now, all of a sudden, now they're chasing something. So think about if someone's focused on their problem, it's basically like what they're trying to get away from. So it's like, imagine you have a GPS system. And instead of putting in a destination, you put in an anti-destination, right? This is the address I don't want to go to. Your GPS doesn't know what to do with that. But when you put in a destination, here's the address I want to go to, then your GPS can start moving you in that direction. So once we have an energizing outcome, they're energized, they're more creative, they're less fearful, and we start to understand what we need to do in order to get there. So that's step two.
Okay, very good. And my question about step two, Howie, is that I have this view that everyone's different. People are individuals. So what I do with clients is I ask them, what do you think would be more motivating to you if we listed the energizing outcome or the positives of achieving your goal or the disadvantages and negatives of not achieving it, and different people come up with one or the other. But are you suggesting if everyone do the energizing outcome and don't ask them that question?
Whoops. I would start with the energizing outcome just strategically, so we know where we're going. At that point, we're not whitewashing the problem. At that point, once they say, okay, here's where I want to go, here's how I know when I've gotten there, and here's why it's meaningful to me, when they get a sense of, yes, this is something I want, then we return to the problem and kind of explore it, but through the prism of the outcome. Because when you just explore the problem, all you can do is kind of get rid of the problem. So if I'm eating junk food, the answer is stop eating junk food. If I'm eating junk food and the outcome I want is, okay, I want to stop eating junk food for the sake of what? For my health. What do you want to be able to do? You know, I really want to have a relationship with food where I still want to have a couple of, you know, an ice cream once a month, but basically I want to be in control and I want to have a positive outlook on food and not feel like I'm constantly fighting between my inner parent and inner child about being good or bad. Once we have that outcome of I want to be at peace around food, now we can look at the problem of, okay, when are you having the ice creams? 9 o'clock at night. Now we can begin to explore. Well, tell me about that situation. What's right? So each of those moments then can become an opportunity to say, well, what's my demand at this from life at this moment? Like, why do I think, you know, right? You taught me that addictions are basically due to a demand, a preference masquerading as a demand, right? So in that moment, once I know what I want, we can then explore all the negatives and why I want to get rid of them and what's bad about them and all the things they've tried in the past that didn't work, but it's within the prism of where we're going. So that's, I don't know if that's right in every situation. One of the things we wanted to do in the book was to turn a fairly complex coaching process into something that lay people could use to simplify it. So there's certainly, I would certainly listen to you if you say there are nuances and different ways of doing it.
So are you saying that step two is highlight an energizing outcome, but step 2A is look at some of the blocks to that?
Well, that's actually the beginning of step three.
Oh, okay.
Which is identify a hidden opportunity. So this I think relates very much to 3-minute therapy, which is every time you have one of these dysfunctional thoughts, is that a problem or is it an opportunity to do 3-minute therapy homework and free yourself? Right.
So, and this, I'm sorry, I just wanted to jump in here. Howie, you said something just a little while ago that reminded me of a behavioral principle that it's easier to start doing something different quite often than it is to stop doing something. So a replacement behavior, for example, a healthy replacement behavior in lieu of smoking, for example, instead of reaching for the pack of cigarettes, maybe I could do something a little more healthy, like go for a walk or something of that nature.
Absolutely. And very often when we get to the fourth step, which is to create a plan, that's when we identify those things, right? Because we have a sense of the contour of the problem. And you know what's really hard? To not eat something. Like, I don't know how to not do something, but I do know how to do something else. I do know how to have a glass of water or a cup of tea or a hot bath or take a walk or meditate or any number of things. So there's a lot of psychological wisdom that goes into creating plans that work. But the other thing I want to say about step four, we call it a level 10 plan, because the important thing is not that it's right or that it works, but the person has a level 10 out of 10 of confidence that they're going to follow through. Because just as you said earlier, we may have to iterate a whole bunch of times, try things again and again and again. So the idea is that this whole process is to create an experiment that the person we're trying to help is going to run and get data. So instead of, oh, I failed and I'm ashamed of myself, something happened and I've got data with which to create a new plan.
Okay, great, great, great. Okay, so we have the four steps. Are there any subtleties or other aspects that it would be worth adding to the basic outline, to the backbone of this?
I'd say a couple of things. One, when we get to that first part of the opportunity step, we return to the problem. Because the goal of the opportunity step is to find an opportunity in the problem to achieve the outcome. At that point, what I really recommend that we do is get away from generalizations and get into actual stories of what happened. Because if someone will tell you, right, like generalizations are not good in REBT, right? They're kind of, they mask truth.
They really don't specify what the issue is and how to work on it.
And I find people often label themselves. So I say, well, I'm lazy or I have no self-discipline. And that's a story that they're telling themselves that is actually the story itself is blocking any attempts to change it. Because if I am something, then what's the point of changing it? That's who I am. But if we say, okay, so tell me about the last time you were lazy, and they tell us the story, and we ask for specifics and details, like we're watching the movie, we can immediately see, actually, it sounds like you're working two jobs, you're taking care of your aging parents, you've got three kids, you've got a sister in crisis across the country, you know, that doesn't sound lazy. Like, we can get them, when they tell their own story, to see the holes in it, and to come up with new interpretations that are more empowering.
Yeah, very good, very good. What comes to mind, Howie, is the most common transgressor of this is Alcoholics Anonymous, where you check in and you say, I am an alcoholic. And as you're saying, if you are an alcoholic, if that's your identity, if that's your essence, obviously you can't change, but it's really just a behavior. It's not the total you.
Yeah. So I'm very, you know, and again, addictions is way above my pay grade. But in general, I want people to avoid generalizations, and I want to explore the facts. So when people separate the facts from their interpretation, and they can identify, even like learn to, it's almost like learning syntax and grammar, like we did like in middle school. Oh, this is a fact, and this is my interpretation of the fact. It can be very hard for people at first to see that, you know, oh, I'm just fat is an interpretation, and the number on the scale or the BMI is the fact, right? So helping people free themselves from negative interpretations that keep them stuck is one of the things we do in the opportunity step.
Right, right. Now, I disagree with your self-criticism that addictions are above your pay grade. It sounds like your four steps are very well suited to helping people with their addictive behavior, their addicted behavior.
I'm thrilled to hear that. disclaimers are useful, I think, for self-protection.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Very good. Kevin, did you have any other questions?
I think a lot of these things we can conceptualize them in the demands. People say, for example, I must stop eating junk food. And that, of course, is going to cause them to probably continue eating junk food as a behavioral consequence. It's probably going to give them some emotional disturbance. And so learning to let up on that I would rather not eat junk food, but that doesn't mean it's absolutely prohibited, gives them the flexibility to make a more healthy choice. And I'm hearing a lot of the overtones of Albert Ellis's writing and such in what I'm hearing.
Yeah, very good, Kevin. And to build on that, if someone has a must, I must stop eating an unhealthy diet, then that turns them into a critic of themselves. So I wonder if you have a chapter in your book in terms of how you can change other people, a chapter on you're one of these other people, change yourself, and these use these four steps to change yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting because my co-author and I have both tried the steps on ourselves, and they sort of work, but it's much harder to do it by yourself. And one of the things we've realized about the process that actually I've come to really value is that it really highlights how much we need each other. That even though you can do this work on your own, there's things you don't see. There's ways in which we're still inside the bottle and we can't read our own label. What we really wrote the book to be is, here's how people can support each other. And this is important. Like, we live in a very individualistic culture. We're supposed to bootstrap ourselves and, you know, just go do it and be tough. And the fact that we need community, we need support, that change is hard. And in order to change, we need each other. We need to feel respected and cared for and safe. And we need each other's guidance and support, that this is not a solo sport.
Yeah, I think there are individual differences. In my experience, this is true of some people, and I would just change the language a little to say it's often most useful to work in conjunction with other people to work on problems, but it's not necessarily a dire necessity. Some people do make changes on their own. But along the lines of other people, I have a practice I do, which I haven't written about, with a friend called co-mentoring. So we meet for 30 minutes every other week, and for 15 minutes, he discusses a problem of his, and I give him suggestions, and then for the other 15 minutes, I discuss a problem, and he gives me suggestions. So certainly for many people, and I'm one of those, working in conjunction with someone else is particularly useful. So I certainly go along with a lot of what you're saying there, Howie.
Yeah, and also we're having these conversations with people who are stuck, right? So absolutely, people change on their own all the time, big changes, little changes. But if we see someone who's stuck and we can be a support for them, as a sounding board, as a thought partner, as someone who's not inside their problem with them.
Right.
I find it's often helpful and almost never harmful if we maintain that allyship. And I'm going to read again, unconditional other acceptance.
Right, right. And not only as a sounding board, but also in terms of practicing these four steps that you recommend in helping them, and then they could practice these four steps in helping you.
My fantasy is that people will go buy this book in order to give it to someone and say, hey, would you do this with me?
That is great. That is great. Have you suggested that in the book?
I haven't read it lately. I have to.
Right.
I have to. Right.
Well, if it's not there, put it in your revised new edition.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny. Like, you know, we wrote like 100,000 words and there's 40,000 in the finished book. So God knows what we left out.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Any final words, Howie, what you'd like to recommend to your readers or listeners who would like to help others?
Well, obviously I would encourage them to get this book because it's my, you know, last 20 years of my best thinking. An experience in there, and it's my own experience, and it's being mentored by people like you, and you know, the thousands, the hundreds of people I've had on my podcast who have shared their methodologies. I would say, you know, the most important thing is to the first step is to, if we can become allies of each other rather than critics, like to me, like when I look at the world, it's quite parched. There's like a drought and people are not flourishing. And I think the water that we can each of us bring to that is kindness and care. And as you say, unconditional other acceptance. I think that's a far more revolutionary stance in the world than we may give it credit for.
Okay. Very good. Very good. In conclusion, we've been speaking with Howard Jacobson, the author of a number of books. The latest is You Can Change Other People, and you've written it with a co-author. What's your co-author's name?
Yeah, Peter Bregman. So he's a very well-known, well-respected executive coach. And so thank you for reminding me to mention him, because it really is largely his methodology, because I'm a student of his coach training. So I get confused on what I know and what he knows, but he is really the source of much of the inspiration and much of the methodology itself. So thank you for reminding me to mention him.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So get Howie's book, You Can Change Other People, Howard Jacobson, and give it out to all your friends so they can change you, or at least help you change. And thank you, Kevin, as usual, for being my trusted REBT partner, and Chris Rossini, who's the technical expert behind the wings. And we certainly benefit from his help this time. And I'm Dr. Michael Edelstein, REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapist, clinical psychologist. And if you enjoyed this discussion, please give us a like. put your comments below, any questions you might have or disagreements, and we'll respond to them. If you'd like to be a guest on our podcast, and looks like Howie survived, so you probably will too. If you'd like to come on and discuss a problem or be a guest, if you're a therapist and you'd like some supervisory suggestions, we welcome you. And continue watching 3 Minute Therapy Podcast to stay on the rational side of life.